Terra Informa. Music has a strong ability to communicate complex topics and emotions. For this reason, music is seen as an effective medium to advocate for social change. In effect, any idea that seeks to alter the course of human history. It's no surprise, then, that environmentalism has found itself woven in a significant number of musical works produced in the last 50 or 60 odd years. After all, the climate crisis defines this moment in time, and without immediate action, climate change represents a global threat to the continuation of human civilization. But let's take a step back for a second. For most people, who or what comes to mind at the mention of musical environmentalism? Perhaps Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell and her 1970s hit Big Yellow Taxi. Or maybe the likes of Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, or Malvina Reynolds, with their prolific careers in folk music. Or maybe contemporary artists like Bob Dylan, Neil Young, U2, or Radiohead. The most glaring observation across these examples is that popular musical environmentalism reflects what Timo Mueller and Elaine Philippe Durand call the pale of white environmentalism. And to a lesser extent, it also highlights the oversized representation of folk and folk rock in the realm of musical environmentalism. So today on Terra Informa, I want to dive into the underrepresented and the underrecognized, the people and genres who remain situated in the background of a wide body of musical works which touch on environmentalism. My name is Jacinta Royangeza, and I'll be your host for the next half hour of environmental news, stories, and ideas. Before we begin this episode, I would like to acknowledge that this episode was produced on Treaty 6 territory in Amiskachiwaskaigan, Beaver Hills House, or so-called Edmonton. We're broadcasting from unrecognized Papas Chase Cree territory. The Papas Chase Cree were displaced following consistent efforts from local officials, like Frank Oliver, to discredit the legitimacy of their treaty right to this territory and to reserve number 136, now South Edmonton. Not confined to history, this region is also the present homelands of many First Peoples, who build their lives here, pursue livelihoods, and gather together. In so-called Edmonton, this includes the Cree, Métis, Blackfoot, and Dene. For this episode's guest, who lives in so-called Seattle, this includes the Coast Salish peoples. Wherever you're listening from, we ask you to consider whose version of history informs your understanding of the land you're on. This episode begins with a discussion about the lack of representation for Black musicians whose work engages with a variety of environmental themes. I chose this particular focus for this episode because it's one that resonates with me most as a Black woman. But there are many other racialized communities whose contributions to musical environmentalism are not being covered by this focus. We invite you to seek out and support their work. This week, we're diving into the underrepresented and the underrecognized, the people and genres who many people don't think about when considering environmentalism and music. To start today's episode, I'm bringing you my conversation with Rashina Fountain, who I'll let introduce herself in her own words.
My name is Rashina Fountain. My pronouns are she, her. I am a poet, an essayist, and an educator originally from Chicago, but I now live in Seattle. And so I am a writer by trade, I would say, but I kind of took a detour on my writing career, and a good detour. And I also have an environmental background as well. So I have a Master of Education in Urban Environmental Education. A lot of what I do is mixing that creative background, that writing background, with a lot of ecology and science, because I have that interdisciplinary experience.
So the theme of this episode is environmentalism in music. And so could I ask you, when you think about environmentalism in music or music with environmental themes, what comes to mind to you?
Yeah, environmentalism in music is something that gets me super excited. It is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I think that maybe I've been thinking about longer than I thought, you know. So I think of, when I think of it, I think of blues. I think of specific song or Negro spirituals a lot. I grew up in the church, the Black church. So my family is from the Black Pentecostal tradition. They are part of the Great Migration. And so I spent a lot of time growing up singing Negro spirituals and being in church and being around outdoor revivals and things like that. So I would say that that's kind of like my early exposure to like music and environmentalism, or music in with environmental themes. But if I think more recently, I would say one of the songs that I think about that really encapsulates this relationship with nature and music for me is like Marvin Gaye's like Mercy, Mercy Me. And it's also called The Ecology. And that's a song that I like to think about when I'm thinking about environmentalism and music.
So you mentioned Marvin Gaye's Mercy, Mercy, Me, The Ecology, and blues and Negro spirituals, which I think would be fair to say have uniquely Black American histories. But when others think about environmentalism and music, they're thinking about the Bob Dylans or the Joni Mitchells of the world. So why do you think that the images invoked by others are primarily white?
Yeah, I feel like I could go many ways in answering that. For one, if we look at the history of music and the music industry in general and erasure, that's one route I could go, right? So a lot of artists, like some of the early blues artists, like Robert Johnson, who is said to be like the father of like Mississippi Delta blues, you know, they didn't really have the exposure that a lot of the white artists had, but a lot of those white artists were influenced by some of these early blues musicians and early folk musicians that didn't have exposure, or, you know, were erased, or whose song, you know, for many reasons because of racism. And so that's one route I could go. But also, I think when we think about environmentalism in general, or not me, but just the ethos within society, that it is white, right? It is like people thinking about protest and maybe people being tied to trees, or, you know, tying themselves to trees to save them and things like that. And so I will say that a lot of early what was seen as environmentalism was shown as that, you know, shown as this kind of white, kind of free, kind of pristine relationship with nature. And so when you talk about Marvin Gaye's Mercy, Mercy Me, right? So that song specifically, right, is talking about environmental degradation. Right, is talking about a lot of issues that disproportionately impact Black communities and impact Indigenous communities, and so that song may not present this like worry-free kind of I'm just connected with nature point of view, right? So it is, I think, a lot of the songs, even when I talk about like Negro spirituals or talk about some of the gospel music that I have been exposed to, right? So it isn't in the realm of we go into the forest and we find ourselves, and you know, there's this return to nature that we want to rediscover, right? So, you know, in the early Negro spirituals, you know, there's like aspirations of freedom, right? There is work in the fields as sharecroppers, as slaves, right? And so there's this like different relationship with nature that isn't necessarily like I'm out here because I'm finding this like freedom or rediscovery. So I would say that there's a couple things, and there's a racist music industry, or the and also there's this like myth of what a traditional nature relationship should look like and who should be delivering that message, right? Somebody like Marvin Gaye, who struggled with addiction and things like that, maybe he doesn't represent that pristine view. Although, you know, maybe some of the artists that you mentioned have similar struggles. But yeah, I would say that is what I think about.
I think racism in the music industry is at the top of people's minds when they consider why Black musicians may not have the same level of mainstream recognition when it comes to musical environmentalism. After all, this is the same music industry that was the intended target of the 2021 Blackout Tuesday event, a call to action for major players across the music industry to reflect on the ways they benefit from or harm Black people in the wake of George Floyd's death. But I want to dive deeper into the myth that guides the nature relationships of Black people and how it impacts their ability to be at the forefront of musical environmentalism.
So there is a myth, and especially an author like Diane DeGlove, Rooted in Earth, is a book that she wrote that goes deep into some of the myths and talks about the idea that Black people have this like lack of empathy or lack of this apathy towards like nature, right? So that is one of the myths. As working in environmental organizations, one of the things that I heard over and over again as a new person entering this space, the question would be, how do we get people of color, how do we get Black people into nature? And that myth was repeated, or that question driven by a myth. And the myth is that Black people do not have this relationship with nature. It points to some of the things that I said earlier about how we express, or how Black people express the relationship with natural environment, right? Or even how Black people are positioned within that discourse. So at times, like in conservation, there can be maybe this empathy for wildlife populations, this empathy for, spaces, green spaces that are not human-centered. There is also, so I say like there's that message, but then there's also this lack of empathy for Black people and our environments, right? And so sometimes that can be that the message of conservation is not the environmentalism that Black people can relate to. Like that would be devoid of care for the historical circumstance, right? So Black people did not necessarily leave nature or had the freedom to say we want to just live in these cities, or you know, we don't want to be in rural areas anymore. In the case of my grandparents, they were part of the Great Migration, and my grandmother is from Marigold, Mississippi, and so she migrated not because she didn't like to have a relationship with the land, but because of racist policies, because of violence, because of lynching, because of more opportunity potentially for freedom in Chicago. And so I will say that kind of relationship with the land is different than a lot of mainstream conservation, how it presents sustainability or presents environmental harmony.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a production of CJSR 88.5. The topic of this episode is environmentalism in music and the perspectives neglected by mainstream images. In the first half of this episode, you heard my conversation with Rasheena Fountain about the lack of mainstream recognitions for Black musicians within musical environmentalism. We're diving back into this conversation, but with a focus on two lesser thought genres, hip-hop and blues.
Yeah, I think because of the erasure and because of attitudes in mainstream environmentalism, like music is a good clue and a good way to kind of remember Black environmental relationships. And so I would say folk music. I mentioned that earlier, right? And you mentioned people like Bob Dylan. Tracy Chapman, you know, is someone. One of my favorite songs of hers is Rape of the World. And that is a song that talks about environmental degradation. And I would say that majority of the songs that I've found happen to talk about environmental pollution and degradation. And I think because if you think about a genre like hip hop, right? Yeah, hip hop was built in urban centers, right? And so a lot of the most impacted people for environmental pollution and environmental degradation would happened in those urban centers. Like, and so I will say that, I would say hip hop is a good glimpse into people talking about their environment. Mos Def has made songs about the natural world. Who else? Common and the Hip Hop Caucus at the height of the Flint, Michigan. I don't know if that's like everyone's familiar with that in terms of United States. Flint, Michigan had a water crisis where there was a high amount of lead in the water, so high that it was causing like lesions on people's skin. That's happening right now in Jackson, Mississippi as well. But yeah, at the height of that, the hip hop artist Common came together along with the Hip Hop Caucus and made a song that was called Trouble in Our Water. Right. And it was the video for that was really powerful. And I think that there is just like a long tradition of activism in general in hip hop. Right. So the beginnings of hip hop were to voice some of the concerns or social issues for people who didn't necessarily have a voice in like mainstream. And I know everyone listens to hip hop now, right? But before, it was a tool. And I think that just like it's a tool to talk about any issue, and artists are and have used it to talk about environmental degradation.
So I want to shift away from hip hop and maybe towards another genre, specifically blues. And I chose blues because I think it would be accurate to say that you consider yourself a blues artist, if not, then a blues guitarist. And if you don't mind me asking, how did you develop that interest, and how do you see environmentalism being incorporated into the genre, or how do you incorporate it yourself?
Yeah, I could talk about the blues. I would consider myself a blues guitarist. As I said, I grew up in church, and my great-grandparents have a church in it used to be on the west side of Chicago, but now it's in a suburb of Chicago. And my father plays music and plays guitar. And so I grew up what I thought was just playing gospel music. But then I learned that I was also kind of playing the blues because they're, you know, it was like Southern music. And then I started to research blues artists and played at a blues club and did a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah, so I would say that I first got into that practice in the church, but then I switched up, which is a lot of the story of many blues people, and you know, the devil's music, maybe is what people would say that I did. But yeah, and so I would say I'm drawn to blues because of a lot of, I would say, the spiritual outlet. And what I mean by that is blues for me is another way of communicating, right? So it's like access to this Black way of knowing and being that isn't communicated with speech, right? I mean, there are singers who sing it, but in terms of guitar playing, it's this improvisational practice that really comes from feeling, you know, from a feeling that you feel within a certain set of notes. And so these feelings, these notes are from my grandmother is from the Mississippi Delta. And so these notes that I'm playing and this way of playing is like in some ways a way that I can communicate with the past, right? Can connect with the past that I feel kind of severed from because of displacement and things like that. Yeah, so blues for me is like how I can like travel, right, to the South that I don't necessarily have as much access as I used to. And in terms of blues and environment, I think so I use blues mood. And so blues is actually you use it in music, but it's also just like a mood, right? It's like the way that you can communicate this kind of sad, depressive, or it can be a way of communicating like sexuality. There's so many. So there's like this blues mood in Black tradition. And so the way that I use blues is I use it within my writing to communicate environmental relationships, right? So it's a way that I kind of like and the way that I do that is I try to do a lot of improvisation within my writing as well. So again, trying to communicate a way of being and a way of knowing. And so yeah, so I say I use it in my writing, and especially in trying to communicate Black environmental relationships or even my relationship, because I feel like kind of what we talked about earlier is this this complication, right, with the environment in a lot of spaces for Black people, right? So as someone being displaced, right, from Africa, but also discontinued displacement that is happening, that continues to happen, and things like that. So when I think about like environmental relationships or being close with the land, there's this extra element, an extra history that we have to think about. We have to think of, you know, that is in my memory or in my family's memory, and that is relationship with trees, right? And South lynching, that is relationship, with space, with, you know, having to pick cotton. And so I think blues is representative of all of that. It's like pretty, you hear it. We've been able to take something really painful and turn it into something really pretty. But it's also this like sorrow that you express that isn't expressed with words. And I think that, yeah, and especially as it relates to the land too. It's a lot of blues was created in the Mississippi Delta. That is a place of enslavement and sharecropping and a lot of violent history and things like that. And so I think that that's why I utilize blues in my practice. That's why I feel connected to it as well.
Yeah, I feel like blues is an under-examined genre when it comes to musical environmentalism, especially because it has like a long history of telling stories about environmental relationships or even just covering different environmental themes like environmental vulnerability or displacement or just like environmental justice in general. And that's especially true with like its origins tied to the Mississippi Delta, as you mentioned, where flooding dates back kind of decades, if not centuries, and people in the area are pretty vulnerable to climate change and its effects. But yeah, that it still remains an underrated genre. So we're coming close to the end of the interview, but I just wanted to ask if you had any final thoughts to share.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's a great like revisiting Black music and looking at whether that's folk, funk, blues, hip hop, and just like revisiting it, I think is a good way to kind of understand Black environmental relationships and a way to see that the myth, you know, see the myth in that's conveyed in society, that Black people have had, always had, whether that's like in some ways forcibly, but like had a relationship with nature. And so the relationship that is often pushed into mainstream society is definitely not the only way to have a relationship with the environment.
Yeah, so we're at the end of the interview now. So I just wanted to ask, is there anywhere people can reach you for more information or to engage more with your work?
Yeah, so I need to update my website. But I'll be doing that in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, rashinafountain.com is where I try to link everything that I'm doing, anything that I'm working on. Yeah, I will say that rashinafountain.com, Climate Conscious Collabs, contains some of my work. I do have, in the process of getting my memoir out there. So that'll be on rashinafountain.com.
If you would like to engage with more of Rashina's work, she is hosting an online workshop with Tree Song on October 29th called Decolonizing Senses. The registration link is in the show notes. That's all the time we have for this week. I've been your host, Jacinta Roy-Ngeza. Thank you for listening. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 FM. And all of our content is created by a team of volunteers. Big shout out this week to Rashina Found for the interview. This episode was written and produced by me, Jacinta Roy-Ngeza. You can reach us for comment or questions via email, tara@cjsr.com, or message us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Terra Informa. For previous episodes, check out our website, terrainforma.ca. Catch you next week, right here on Terra Informa.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all. And it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses